welcome to DAC Beechcroft's Lawcast. I'm Nikki Fairbairn. I'm a commercial real estate partner here at DAC Beechcroft. Today we're going to be talking about another area of commercial real estate, but it's about refurbishment of existing buildings. It's something I'm seeing quite a lot of at the moment. We're going to be talking about where the liability sits for building condition when you're actually fitting out those refurbished buildings. So joining me today is Jonathan Bond. He's a partner specialising in non-contentious construction, and Jonathan and I quite often work together on projects, particularly when there's the need to have development obligations in, for example, an agreement for lease, or where we're talking about ensuring that construction obligations flow down into fit-out construction contracts. So Jonathan, welcome today.
Thanks, Nikki. It's lovely to be here.
Let's set the bigger picture in that case. So fit-out works, they're not new, obviously, especially in multi-let buildings, but when we're talking about refurbishments, unlike a new build project, they do come with quite a lot of unexpected additional risks. We're talking maybe hidden defects, legacy systems, compatibility with existing services infrastructure. What are you seeing, Jonathan, in terms of current trends and pressures in this sector and type of work?
It's a really difficult market at the moment for a number of reasons, and fit out projects by their very nature are quite complicated. So where previously people were quite pragmatic in terms of looking at what needed to be done and how it would be done, there's a lot more thought going into how and where risk needs to sit, and contractors quite reasonably are far more risk averse in relation to what previously they may have accepted as an obligation, either from a legal risk transfer point or taking a commercial view on how they manage some of these risks.
And so if we talk about risk for a bit, how do clients go about delivering a fit-out project? I'm guessing there's a number of sort of steps or actions that they've got to take. What I suppose does good practice look like when you're procuring a fit-out contract?
You're absolutely right. There are lots of steps involved, and good practice, really. You should try to work through all of them to make sure that everybody understands their risk and what it is they're signing up to. Starting at the very beginning, there's always the legal and the regulatory framework that both the tenant or the party procuring the fit-out works and the contractors need to abide by. So there are those overarching obligations under the CDM regulations and the building regulations, and there is the need to appoint a CDM principal designer and building regulations principal designer at the earliest stage of a project. Good practice requires the appointment to be in writing, and this is an important role as it involves the planning, managing and coordination of health and safety during the pre-contract phase, which then goes forward to help to eliminate risks, as well as ensuring other designers comply with their obligations as the design is developed for fit-out works.
And you mentioned their building regulations principal designer. Isn't that only needed for higher risk buildings?
It's an excellent question, and it's often one that people think the answer to that is yes, but this is one example where the Building Safety Act, through the various statutory amendments that it enacts, it extends to all construction projects. And there is that need to ensure that competent designers are appointed, and that there should be a building regulations principal designer on all projects. And in addition to the principal designer, then there's always the need to make sure all other consultants are appointed properly as well. Typically for a fit out project, you would expect an architect, an M&E engineer, and depending on the nature of the project, there might be a civil and structural engineer as well. Early contractor involvement is also helpful, as it helps clients understand buildability and delivery challenges, which sometimes are overlooked during the design development phase. A lot of this is relatively straightforward, but quite often a lot of these actions either aren't carried out at all or they're rushed, and due diligence can be replaced by tender clarifications and caveats, which can then lead to disputes when contractual risk allocation isn't clear or properly understood by the parties.
So I suppose people might be interested in trying to understand what would help them from a practical perspective. Have you got any tips?
Absolutely. It's really important to investigate the building. And sometimes that starts with first principles in terms of how do you get in and out and where is it in relation to other buildings in its location. Don't rely on assumptions about the existing structures, or if your contractor side, if you're seeking to rely on unwarranted or out-of-date reports that don't really help you or cause bigger problems. And sensibly document everything. So when you are in meetings, make sure who's expected to do what, make sure that relevant surveys are carried out properly and all parties understand what it is that they're being asked to do so that risk is managed throughout the pre-contract period. And then once you do get to contract, make sure that the contract is unambiguous and risk allocation is properly set out.
And so we identify all of the risks and then start to draft the agreements. Obviously, from my perspective as well, there's the agreement for lease that will sit above the fit-out contract. But talking about that fit-out contract, what sort of contract is typically used for fit-out works?
We still tend to see JCT being the primary sort of suite of contracts used in this space, depending on the value and nature of the works and sometimes specific requirements that a landlord might impose on a tenant doing fit-out works. It might be the JCT design and build contract. This is the most robust contract and offers a client the most control over the project of the works. They've just updated their contract to move from the JCT 2016 suite to the 2024 suite, which doesn't massively change the risk profile in relation to fit-out works. One clause just to touch on is the insurance clauses in Section 6 of the contract. The reason it's important to touch on this is this clause doesn't always clearly allocate risk for existing structures, particularly where the employer under a fit-out contract is a tenant rather than a landlord. And it's increasingly common for landlords to resist co-insurance or a waiver of subrogation rights under their insurance due to the increased risk of claims and then the increase in future premium costs where there are claims. So sometimes when you are working through a fit-out contract, you have to make bespoke amendments to allow for reliance on the contractor's public liability insurance, which may not always fully respond to or cover damage to the existing structure.
And you've touched on there a couple of things probably that get us into the remit of what happens when things go wrong. They do sometimes. I mean, is it because of scope or design or bad drafting? And who's responsible? What happens there, do you think?
Sometimes it's all of these things. And quite often it's driven by the very short time periods that both parties have to get into contract to get fit out works done so that a tenant can get in and start to occupy and use their space. Sometimes it's driven by scope creep or unexpected works that then lead to disputes. There's a couple of recent cases that touch on this, which are quite similar on their facts but had very different outcomes. The first case related to the design and construction of stair pressurization works to ensure smoke-free stair cores in the case of fire in an existing 30-story office tower. And the parties to this contract did sign a JCT design and build contract. It was very heavily amended, and the contractor accepted full design responsibility for the whole of the design, including everything that was contained in the employer's requirements, everything that was required to comply with statutory requirements. And there was further additional obligations that transferred all physical condition and other condition risk onto the contractor. And the contractor was deemed to have taken all necessary steps to assess this risk and to have fully acquainted themselves with the information needed to carry out the works. The contract went further, and any failure on the part of the contractor to discover or foresee any conditions that they hadn't priced or programmed for sat with them, and it was all a contractor risk. The works included the removal of an existing system, so a legacy system which the contractor didn't have full knowledge of, and then the design and construction of an upgraded system. Whilst they were trying to do this work, the contractor discovered additional asbestos in the building, along with additional structural works that had to be carried out that weren't foreseen as the original scope of the works. And a dispute arose in relation to this, primarily because the contractor quite reasonably said, well, this isn't what I signed up for, and it's not what I've been asked to do. And ultimately, because of the way the contract was drafted, for the complete delivery of the new stair pressurization system, all of these additional technical time and cost risk challenges were deemed to be a contractor risk. And they had nowhere to go in terms of the claim for additional time and additional money to complete these works. So it's a really good example of where, because of the breadth of the contract and the absolute risk transfer, the nature of the risk transfer was wider than the scope of the works. And unfortunately for the contractor, they struggled to recover the additional time and cost they needed to complete these works. A very similar case where the legal risk profile was almost the same as the previous case, related to the fit out of a mill. And exactly the same scenario arose, and the contractor ran into difficulties. And the fundamental difference here was that the contractor had qualified the risk, and the clause that transferred all of the risk of the existing structure to the contractor was subject to a clarification which confirmed that existing structures were an employer risk. And because of this, when this went before the courts, the court held that the contractor was absolutely right, and they could make an application to recover additional time and cost to complete the works, rather than be left with the significant additional risk that they would have no means to recover the additional time or cost that they would have otherwise been put to. So this is a really good example of taking the time to understand the contract, and then where it's not quite right, either expressly change it so that it is right, or qualify the risk so that if a scenario does arise, you've got the appropriate means to recover additional time and money.
And I suppose, just to try and wrap this up in that case, Jonathan, we have this arrangement in many cases sitting under an agreement for lease scenario, and having to align the landlord and tenant arrangements with the fit out works. I mean, what does all that mean, do you think, in terms of how do transaction documents need to be drafted? What are the couple of key takeaways, perhaps?
From a construction perspective, the scope of the work should mirror that of the demise or and the nature of the lease. A contractor shouldn't really be taking any risk beyond that of the area within which they're working, and then making sure that the risk profile of the contract is very clearly drafted so that allocation of risk is clear and it's consistent with all of the transaction documents. Similarly, when you are acting for the employer, as tenant perhaps, this is equally true, and there is no real reason why additional risk should be transferred when it doesn't need to be. And so if we get our procurement strategy right from day one, and work with a good professional team, these scenarios hopefully shouldn't arise.
Thanks for that, Jonathan. That's brilliant. And it's a reminder, I think, about the importance of working hand in hand between the property and the construction elements on these transactions, just to make sure that things really do flow down to the granular detail of the contracts for the works that are being delivered. Thank you so much for taking the time to catch up with me today, Jonathan, and thank you also to all of our listeners. We look forward to having you back for another episode of the DAC Beechcroft Lawcast soon. Many thanks.